Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Good afternoon. My name is Brian Topher, Principal Architect of Topher Architecture. And you are listening to New Books Architecture, a podcast channel in the New Books Network dedicated to architecture and its publications. If you have any suggestions on authors who you would love to hear me speak with next, feel free to send me an email at btopher@topherarchitecture.com. Today's guest is Thomas Hubka to talk about his book, How the Working Class Home Became Modern. Thomas Hubka is Professor Emeritus of Architecture at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee, and author of books such as Big House, Little House, Back House, Barn, The Connected Farm Buildings of New England, as well as Resplendent Synagogue and Houses Without Names. Thank you very much for being here with me today and talking. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So before we begin, can you tell the audience a little bit more about yourself?
When I was 8 years old in, I guess, third grade or so, they passed around a career outline and what do you want to be? And I put architect down, and that hasn't changed. So it's been a long, happy trip for me. And it's been continually architecture. Most people don't do that. They change, but I didn't. And I'm pleased with that.
That's very interesting.
I grew up in New Jersey, suburban kid. And I went to Carnegie Mellon University in architecture and graduated there. I've turned into an academic. I primarily like teaching. And I still love teaching when I can. On the side, for about 5 years, I practiced in Maine. I did, for me, a load of buildings. I would secure the project, and I would usually find firms that wanted to work with me and produce it and all that. So Town Hall in Norway, Episcopal Church in Freeport, and Library Edition in Freeport, and housing, condominiums, and things like that. But I'm an academic, and I spent most of my life teaching and writing books. And that's what we're going to talk about.
Yes. And I accidentally interrupted you. I was curious. Most people don't have an interest in being an architect, particularly at a young age. It seems to come at a later age. You know, what was your spark as a young child?
It was always the visualization, the curiosity about the visual, and excitement about buildings, and just the how they're made and all that. I turned out to be more of an anthropologist, and I listen pretty well, it seems. However, I don't write well. I'm an architect. I draw and I visualize, and I correct well, luckily. So that's the reason why my books can be read, I guess. But primary visual.
Absolutely. And so we'll dive right into it. So the thing that I wanted to start with, and of course we'll go into much more detail, but kind of an overview. The thing that was most jarring to me, and I think would be most jarring to most people, is the focus of your book is talking about kind of the, you call it the middle majority, and the fact that there's this building type and this segment of the population that has almost no architectural study on it. And so I was wondering if you could, I know that's a brief overview, if you could kind of elaborate on that a little more for us.
Well, for academics that are out there, no academic study is not right, not a lot. And so whenever you go no, there's a literature out there. But if you look at the architectural historical literature about architecture within housing, and so there's lots of other branches and all, I think you'll find there are, the subject is dominated by big houses, architect-designed houses. And so I make a distinction throughout the book that most of the houses that I talk about in my books are designed by builders, contractors, developers, builders, et cetera. And they're a wily group, and I've written about their design methods, which is not written about so much and all that. And most of us architects would snicker and say, you mean copying and all that. And yes, in a way, but it is the way that most houses have been designed. And if we look at the big total of houses, my screen just went there. Okay, fine. If you just look at the total of housing, to say it's not studied is, I mean, people know about ranch houses, okay, and Levittown and other groups of houses, but and also the title of my book is How the Working Class Home Became Modern, 1900 to 1940, and so there's a date in there, and so it's before Levittowns and all that, and so for the listener, it's the house that I'm trying to houses that I'm trying to have you think about are the most popular houses between the early to 20th century. What is that? The bungalow stands out, and others like that, but duplexes and small what I would call working class houses or working class cottages are the dominant mode. I mean, we just don't think about it that way. And one of the things I did was to go into towns and cities and count historically houses and identify the most dominant types. And that would be surprising to many architects or average people about what those houses would be. It's just not a subject you do a lot of times. I mean, they're humble houses. Demographically, they're smaller kinds of houses and all that. But it's those houses that I've primarily researched.
Right. And you had mentioned the fact that a big challenge here is that you challenge a lot of people's assumptions. If you were to talk about older houses, I think a lot of people, and you do talk about the fact, a lot of people assume that they all look like the larger scale homes that are still around. But the problem is that's not the majority of what was built. That just happens. They have a better survival rate. And so you had just mentioned the date of the title that I mistakenly left out, 1900 to 1940. Could you maybe explain to us a little bit why that time period is so significant in your study?
Well, the loaded word in my title is how the working class home became modern. And so all of a sudden, us modernist architect types get our hair stands up and all that. What do you mean by modern? And so I make I have a diagram of my book comparing a bungalow, a modest bungalow, with a version of a Corbusier modern house. So, and I say both of these houses are modern because they have modern utilities in them, component parts, manufactured parts, and all that. Although they look differently, they act similarly, and both of them have been modernized in some ways. So that it's designed to shake you up a little bit if you've been trained a certain way. But I think I can sustain that argument about the modernization of domestic life. And that's what so between 1900 to 1940, I say the dominant American middle class modernized their domestic environments. And I count what that would be. So they get a three fixture bath. And the thing that is the surprise is that I say before they had or got the three fixture bath in the common bungalow about 1920s and all that, they had an outhouse. Now, the upper classes in the larger houses had either servants and night soil people to take things out and all that, or early bathroom facilities and all. But the working class or the dominant majority culture in America did not have bathrooms until 1900 to 1940. And that's so I say during this period, this middle majority of people, whatever you want to call them, middle class, I don't care, but the numerical number of these people, they modernized their domestic traditions. And that needs to be emphasized. And it isn't so much at all emphasized, I think, in the dominant literature of what I call American housing reform. You know, if you look at the books, it isn't that it's a sinister leak that eliminates working class houses. It's just that you concentrate on larger houses. Also, you concentrate on first application. And if you look at the literature of the technology, housing technology, you concentrate on Thomas Bell, the electric light, you know, bingo, 1880s. Well, when did the electric light get into common houses? It's one of the first utility to come in, but generally after about 1900, the working class achieves electricity and all that. And what interesting with the technology, many of the listeners might know the image of a Victorian a dining room or hall or whatever with gas lighting, the great fixtures of gas lighting. The working class never got gas lighting because they just simply their houses weren't equipped for gas. And when they were about to do that, they got electricity. So they went from candles and kerosene lamps and things like that to electric lights without going through a gas lighting stage. So here's a way that the working class achieved their own development technologically. That is not the same. So you don't want to read just about upper class development of gas lighting fixtures and things like that, because there's another story of majority culture.
Absolutely. And I'm jumping around a little bit. Later on in the book, you do kind of mention the fact that it's overlooked a lot that there is a significant, this is not a gradual evolution. There was a very significant change from almost a primitive living situation to a modern, as you just said. And again, I jumped ahead a little bit, but I think that was something that stuck out to me, you know, the fact that it's not very gradual. Like you said, they went from candle right to electricity.
Yes. Yeah. And of course, the upper classes had a much more gradual, because their gas lighting goes back to the 1880s or 70s in some cases or whatever. Anyway, it means that there's a more condensed period. The development of the porcelain sinks and toilets. I emphasize the three fixture bathroom. This is the trinity of housing improvement. I mean, it came in a rush in the bungalow type house and replaced the outdoor outhouse. And it brought an immense change of lifestyle in terms of hygiene, privacy, childcare, all the way down the list. It's big time social change. And it happened for a majority of the population below the upper, what I'd say, upper classes. I make a distinction between upper class 20 to 30%, the middle majority 60%, and the lower working class 20 to 30%. That changes in time and during depression and all that, but as a general working figure, it's acceptable, I think, with most sociologists who look at things like that, economists.
Absolutely. And so you had kind of already hinted at it, but so maybe we can go into it a little more. You had mentioned there later on that, you know, there's a lot to talk about, but there is kind of nine great improvements to the housing standard. And again, I won't ask you to list all nine of them, but you already talked about the idea that, you know, the three fixture and bathroom was a big deal. But I guess I'd be curious to hear a little bit more. You know, some of them, for example, are not something, it does sound like we talk a lot about kind of the utilities and technological, but there were other more design ideas such as, you know, dining, private bedrooms, and specialized rooms instead of the general room.
Yes. I have a list of them. I say nine. I mean, it could be 12 or 10 or seven. But the first three, the most important, are the three fixture bathroom, and I would then say modern utilities. I mean, that's a quantum leap. And anybody who looks at this will say that the modern utilities are major. And then I have a big category to say kitchen appliances. But the big three I would say is washing machine, refrigerator, and vacuum cleaner in some ways, because it's woman's work is what it turns out to be. And that was improved dramatically during this period. But then I go down and say there are other improvements that are not so important, but they characterized how the working class became middle class. And I think the dining room is one of the keys there. In very humble homes, this new room appeared. It was never a dining room out before in the working class before 1900, basically, and all that. People ate in the kitchen ever since Adam and Eve, so it's continuous. And then this room, and it's used for homework. It isn't always used for dining at all because it's this place that is enshrined, and it becomes a working class standard even in modest homes. I didn't say privacy of bedrooms. Bedrooms are always there a little bit, but what happens in working class homes around 1900, before 1900, is that in houses of three or four rooms, rooms are multi-used and they're not single purpose. So you don't have a single purpose living room, dining room, kitchen, bed. You know, it all happens in lots of rooms, and particularly like the kitchen, you always see in working class photos the rare beds within the kitchen. Sometimes the kitchen has the only heat source, so that is a way to. I lost the screen. We still there. Okay. So private bedrooms. Another category is houses get bigger. The technology of wood technology in America, it just explodes between the Civil War to 1900. And really, we get the shells of houses that are built that are of 21st century standards, actually, with the windows and doors of production independently and all that. By 1900, if these become, the shell becomes very modern, but the inside, the technologies are not there. So there's a kind of that. So the house itself as a building shell improves. And then I list little things of more like closets. It's a small item in some ways, but if you think about a closet, working class houses never had closets. It's just, because they didn't have anything to store. But what you get is the production of American, a cornucopia of just stuff that starts to pour out of mass production after 1900. The Roaring Twenties is really the era, I think, of dominant housing goods that starts to pour out. And this is put into, so all of a sudden we have in modest houses, linen closets, coat closets in the entranceway. Now, this is coupled with the production of cotton goods throughout the world and all that. And so lots of things are kicking in here. But nevertheless, we have houses that are, I would say, becoming modern. And I put into the last ones, recreational porches. Porches are always there in the working class. You can slaughter your pig if you're living in the countryside. But now we have a porch for the eight-hour day, for the possibility of recreation. And so the bungalow, I think, achieves that. And I list the automobile last because it changes American culture on all levels, and no one would disagree with.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccoli, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Thank you. That was a great explanation of all of that. And that's kind of another assumption that I know I personally, I guess, even as an architect, had always assumed that maybe houses weren't as comfortable and as nice as they are, but they were always very similar. Whereas you actually mentioned that, you know, with an emphasis more on utilitarianism, whether comfort, you know, and for example, you list 9 common houses, and I would urge anyone listening to look them up. And there's one that's called the shotgun, which is a literal row of rooms that you have to walk through to get to each room. And so as an architect, I looked at that and I cringed at the idea of walking through rooms to get to it. And again, so that kind of challenged the assumption that houses didn't look like our houses do now. They were much different, as you said. you didn't have a bedroom that was just for you to sleep in. There wasn't a room that you just ate food in. You just had a series of rooms that you did everything and everywhere.
That's right. It's surprising. So I think an important part of my research, it's in the beginning of the book, as I say, here are nine houses, or they're the most dominant houses in America in 1900 or before improvement started. You know, there are three or four rooms and they have names that no one knows, just specialists and all that, I house and side gable. I mean, nobody agrees on their names. And even in architectural literature is usually dominated by upper class houses, as you can name styles, the Greek Revival and Colonial and all that. Well, these houses may have a little architectural detail on it, but you can't. And one of my, I guess, major emphasis in my research, in which I like to think I try to enforce and would be a good idea for most historians, is to evaluate these houses by plan. And this is the thing architects do. We memorize plan. I mean, that's sort of the typology of plan. And if you don't do plan, you'll never record these houses, because they just disappear into stylistic categories. In other words, from the outside, it's hopeless to try to categorize them. But by plan, solid. And the further down you go into the working class, the more common, ordinary plans you have. Not identical, not like, you know, like molecules or anything like that, but a typology that we understand from the way the local builders make architecture. You mentioned the shotgun. It's the only regional house that I have on my list here of the most common houses in 1900. It's a southern house. It's actually the only house with African origins, or Creole African. There's different ways of looking at that. And I smile because it's the most commonly known house name there, but most Northerners or Westerners have never been in a shotgun.
I have never
all of a sudden, here's a house that nobody knows, but it's very common in the South. That's why I listed it as one of the dominant houses in 1900 for most people.
Yeah, and you had mentioned, you know, people's familiarity. You know, I won't pretend to be all over, but I've done a lot of home inspections. I've worked on a lot of debilitated buildings. I have not actually encountered a lot of these building types. So I wonder if
what's your area? I forget where you are from.
I'm in Rochester, New York.
Oh, right. Okay. Well, we call it the side gable, and that's this farmhouse that's out there in vast numbers. It's temple and wing is the way you call it, and it has the classical gable in the front, and then a side gable to the side of the kitchen. You've probably seen that. Okay, in your area, that's a dominant working class kind of house. It's also a house that can get bigger and be a wealthy farmer can have the same kind of house too. So that can happen, you know, because it's just simply the house.
Absolutely. And so you had mentioned that you were very honest about some of the challenge you faced. You've even talked about it here. And one thing I'd love to hear more about is, you have mentioned a big challenge is, you know, poor documentation. So you have these old houses that weren't documented well, but then between residents in permanence and continuous renovations and rehabilitation, a lot of these have, I guess, for lack of a better term, started to fade away almost.
Yes. You know, you could do the Google search and find a lot of houses, but, you know, when you're looking at the picture from the street, you don't know if that house has been remodeled. I mean, I live in a neighborhood that there's no house. It's in a upper middle neighborhood, and every house has been expanded. But you wouldn't know that. But if I get a builder in any town in America and go around, we can nail that with, you know, what are the additions from the outside? Well, what are the additions? And it's what I've done all my life. And so I can talk about the plan typology. Every house has a parent or parents and ancestry, and you can, you know, talk about that. And so there's a kind of democracy of houses that I try to preach about. All houses have history. People look at the little houses and, you know, it's, but, you know, it has a, just like the big houses, they have a, there's a Michelangelo in the background, and we may not know the name, but there's a design development.
Absolutely. And so, you know, keeping with the theme, you know, this kind of this ignored segment of buildings, you know, later on, you mentioned that even when it comes to multi, you know, we've been talking a lot of what sounds like single family, but even the multifamily, again, just like everything else, a lot of literature kind of focused on either the incredibly destitute or the lavish. but there was a very large middle majority, and that not just single family, but multifamily as well.
Yes. A good portion of my book emphasizes multifamily housing. And the literature, of course, concentrates on the single family house. It's the gold standard of most houses in some ways. But during the period I look at, 1900 to 1940, 55 to 60% of the family units were multi-unit. Wow, those are big numbers. Now, multi-unit can be a single-family house subdivided into multi-unit house, and the duplex is one of my favorites. It just stands out as a working-class house during this period, and had the Depression not cut off the development of the duplex, and then New Deal policy support single-family housing, the duplex was online to compete with the single-family house in terms of housing production in America. But all of a sudden, after the Depression, that changes because of lending policies and zoning changes simultaneously. So anyway, the working-class duplex, and I say duplex is the term, it's the late 19th century term and all that, but we don't have a two-flat if you're in a Midwesterner. It's just one plan over another plan. It's the most common duplex in America, and in all over America, it represented housing reform, because these duplexes were almost always produced with the most up to date technologies. And others, new bathrooms and modern utilities and all that, for various reasons I could go into. But so they represented, as they don't do now. They could, it's modest working class accommodations now, perhaps in the urban fringe areas where duplexes occurred. But they were at one time always considered that. New England has a version of that. It's the three decker. Does that term, for most people, understand a little. They've seen New England that way. If you think about that, that is the three units that are stacked on top of each other. And I call this the bungalow plan. Again, there's no common name. We can call it a lot of things. You can call it the three-decker plan. But it's a two parallel lines of rooms. And the big one, design-wise, is the Holy Trinity of living room, dining room, kitchen along one side of the house. Almost, 80% of your listeners have been in a house like that. And along the other side of the house are the bedrooms, usually a double-loaded bath, on the other side of the house. Anyway, the most popular floor plan, this bungalow plan in America before the ranch house here, before the World War II. And these, I'm saying this based on my statistics of case studies throughout the nation and all that. I invite anyone else to say, oh, no, there's another plan out there. Well, fine. Whatever you want. I've worked with the best scholars in the best, and don't have to be scholars. Sometimes the best person is a planning person who happens to know common houses, and my scouts can figure who that out is, and then I go interview them, and we go around and we look at the common houses of your town. I still do that. I love to do it.
Is that right? Well, one question I ask at the end, but maybe now is a better time with that segue. I often am curious, so what have you worked on since the book has come out? Sounds like you still are kind of researching this topic a little bit.
Yes, this is a continuous topic. I like the Russians who do steel mills and dams in their 5 and 10 year plan. I have 15 years it takes me to do a book, mostly because I can't write so well and all that. And I correct a lot. But so I have a couple. The common houses of Portland, Oregon, where I live, that's on the horizon. But I'd like to see the reaction to this book. And there's a couple topics in this book. There's also boarding houses. Talk about a bastard child of neglect. These are the small single unit apartments that are out there near the bus depot or whatever else you live out there that are just not recorded. Well, there's a history of that. The Tenement Museum in New York, have you heard about that museum? It's a tenement museum that is a remarkable cache of history that came along with that. So we can see the development of common families within a tenement house building. But it's, there are tenement house histories of very modest buildings throughout the country of five, 10 rooms or something like that, that constitute a big portion of working class living in America before the reform.
And that's a great point. You know, you do talk about the fact that I think a lot more, if I understood correctly, a lot more people had boarders and renters despite the discomfort than we were led to believe just because of the economic
Absolutely.
Benefit.
It's a tough reading because the family is usually torn between the discomfort of sharing right. your four rooms with one other person and that being one of the only extra sources of income that a working class right. family could possibly have. So it's a kind of split of how you should live.
Right, absolutely. And so on that topic, as much as I didn't want this interview to be me kind of having all my assumptions challenged, there was one more that I would love to hear more about, you know, and it could be my own personal bias. I watched a lot of Western movies growing up. So I think I, along with a lot of people, have that idea that people bought a kit house, took it home, and they and their family put their house together. Now, I'd like you to explain it a little more, but the reality is that's kind of not the case.
It's on my list too of talking about that. When I around the country was a lecture in various places, I can't go into a lecture hall and not say, "And what about the kit house?" You know, after I know what I'm talking about, common houses. Well, you know, usually it's the male contingent here that said, "Well, let me tell you," and it's a cracking good story. I mean, here's the boxcar that pulls up and it's got every component in it. And the thrifty owner, along with the local builder, takes every and then puts the house together. You know, doesn't that feel good? Okay, I call this a creation story. And it's a good story, but it tells us a very small portion of the production of houses in America. By my figures, it's about 3%, that's 0.03%, or maybe 5%. But the problem is that you get a lot of semi-kit house, that they ship out the hardware, you know, and the windows, but they don't do the lumber. You ain't shipping out lumber to Oregon, the capital of the Douglas fir industry during this time from Chicago and make that work. It's just, anyway, you say I'm getting excited here about that. But the point is that the kit house, it tells only a very tiny fraction of the story of how houses are built. How houses get built during this period are by hundreds of thousands of small contractor builders who work with pattern books, and sometimes they have an architect design, and sometimes, but their own traditions, of vernacular traditions that construct these houses. It's a very difficult topic to research, and gee, if I was a researcher, I'd go to a kit house. It's a cool story, and it's quick and easy, but it's so minor. Now, a lot of people are turned off. So please don't turn off. Just recognize that your story is about a very small proportion of the housing industry, the production of houses, and kit houses are, you know, they're legitimate. They occur, but in very small proportions. Do you feel bad? Do you feel can I kick the skids out of your whatever? Anyway.
Well, no, like I said, when I first read it, that's the first thing that came to mind is, again, I watched a lot of Western movies, and that's the image that's
portrayed. Well, a companion one that you should also think about is The Owner Builder. And I would call this The Myth of the Owner Builder. Are there owner builders? Of course. During the pioneer days in the Midwest, everyone built their own house more or less in some ways. But between the Civil War to 1900, this owner builder, the West disappears, the frontier disappears. Okay, and so we have the development of the construction industry, and by 1900, the owner builder is completely limited because you have the development of technological production of electricity and plumbing and things like that. That's so far beyond. Of average builders, and there's no Home Depot, there's no YouTube seminars out there or anything like that. But so anyway, another 3 to 5% maybe. But the problem with home builders is that you have a partial participation of the owner. That's cool. Okay, that happens and all that. But usually when you say owner builder, it's the total package, and that's rare. It has been rare. It still is rare and all that. But you can see how the literature tends to support some because it's just heroic, right?
Absolutely. I would say of all the assumptions challenged, in my mind, at least personally, I think that would be the one that I think a lot of, I think it's a generally accepted fact, and you can't see me, but I'm doing air quotes, that people built their own homes. So I think out of all of them, that's probably, in my mind, the most widespreadly accepted. I don't know if you agree with that or...
Of course, and I do, and particularly if you're in a rural area. Whoa.
Absolutely.
If you know farmers, farmers can fix anything, and they do. But if you study farm production of houses and barns in most areas of the country, you'll find that the local farmer hired or got a local builder to come in to build the barn. Okay. I always show a picture at my lectures about Farmer Jones's barn. I say, who built Farmer Jones's barn? And of course, everyone says Farmer Jones. I said, well, wait a minute. And I showed the local builder, who was anonymous and all that. Did Farmer Jones help with that? Oh, absolutely. You know, and sometimes they help in big ways, but they didn't carry the technical wherewithal with the notching and all that. The average farmers didn't do that. So anyway, there is another myth of common houses that needs to be debunked a little bit to understand the local production of common builders, in the production of common houses.
Absolutely. And so, as I said, we did this out of order. I already asked what you've been working on, but maybe someday we could talk again about all your other books as well. I've already looked into them myself. So for those listening, whether you're an architect or not, I guarantee you have all the same assumptions I did. And so the book is How the Working Class Home Became Modern, 1900 to 1940. I would very much recommend it. Tom, I want to thank you again for being on here and talking with us today.
Can I put a plug for the University of Minnesota Press?
Absolutely. Okay,
they did such a good job. I'm very pleased with it. My little baby.
Absolutely. And we'll be hearing about some of these other books from them as well in future episodes. So. Thank you. And to everyone listening, thank you and have a great day.